great. She clipped him in the hair and she told him what's wrong, but he couldn't keep his
Electric, mind. Richard Thompson's latest CD was recorded over a span of just 4 days, and that may be why it feels so immediate. It's a rapid-fire collection of songs with a flurry of solos from the man Rolling Stone magazine named as one of the 20 greatest guitar players of all time. He's joined by some favorite Nashville mainstays, Alison Krauss, fiddle player Stuart Duncan, and producer-guitarist Buddy Miller, and I'm very pleased that the new record and a concert next month at the Beacon Theater have brought Richard Thompson back to our show. Welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Your new album came out yesterday, and last night you played a show at Joe's Pub in the East Village. How did it go?
I think it went very well. Good response from the crowd.
You've described the new album sound as Celtic funk and somewhere between Judy Collins and Bootsy Collins. Are you inventing a new genre here?
Maybe. It did come out a bit funkier than I was expecting. I'm really, I suppose, a folk musician, and it came out a bit sort of heavier and more hard and driving than I was expecting.
And are you touring with the same musicians who
absolutely.
Were on the record?
Yeah, this is recorded pretty much with a trio, with just guitar, bass, and drums, and I'll be touring with the same format.
The album really has a kind of gritty, almost garagey feel to it. Mm. Did you set out wanting to achieve that?
I think so. Yeah. Well, we recorded it at in a house, and when you do that, sometimes you get a bit of the room sound, get coming through. So,
Buddy Miller's house.
Buddy Miller's house.
He's the producer.
Yeah. I think we were kind of aiming for that kind of thing. You wanted to sound a little bit raw,
And in Nashville, although Nashville usually produce a very highly polished kind
they
of
certainly
sound.
They certainly do. Traditionally, if we had gone into one of the regular Nashville studios, that may have happened. But recording in a house it's a bit funkier.
Well, he's been around a long time, and he's done a wide range of music over the years. How did you wind up connecting to him?
Well, I'd done some shows with him the last few years, and I thought he'd be an interesting person to work with because he's a very sympathetic musician himself. He's a very good accompanist, and I'd heard some of his other studio work that he'd done in his house, the Solomon Burke record, Robert Plant record, for instance, and I really liked the sound of those, and I thought he'd bring something quite special to the project.
As I mentioned, the recording only took 4 days. Does that mean you arrived with everything pretty much worked out? Did you know the songs you were going to record?
Supposedly. I always try and have everything written before we go in.
You're not one of those people who likes to work it out as you're doing the recording?
In the days of, $500,000 budgets, you could do that kind of thing. You could go in with no ideas, nothing written, and just sit around on the studio floor for a couple of weeks and slowly assemble things. I've always liked to have stuff written and at least prepared before going to the studio. And then you have to allow for things to change once you get there. You have to be broad-minded enough to do that. But I think it's good to have a plan A anyway.
Because things, you hear things differently when you're recording it as opposed to when you're performing them live?
Yeah, and I think, every time you play it, it's a little bit different. It's not classical music where it's set in stone. Musicians bring different things every time it gets played. And you have to be prepared for things to shift in a good way.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Suddenly somebody has an idea, there's this little lick, and the next thing you know, you're off in a whole other
Absolutely.
Direction.
And even slight variations in tempo, you play a little faster, a little slower, and it can completely change the feel of something that you're doing.
The lyrics of a number of the songs touch on a very traditional Nashville theme, an unfaithful woman. Was that just a coincidence?
Probably. Well, the roots of Nashville are in Appalachian music. The roots of Appalachian music are in Scots-Irish music. Scots-Irish music is full of songs about, unfaithful. I think there's some unfaithful men is there in there as well. There's a balance.
Well, women often sing about the unfaithful men.
That's true.
So do you see yourself as carrying on a tradition that you brought over from the British Isles?
Absolutely, yeah. I grew up listening to Celtic music, Scottish music, and... And popular music, and you know, there are common threads everywhere, really. You know, nothing's changed that much.
And your earliest recordings with Fairport Convention were very much out of the British folk tradition.
Yeah, with Fairport back in the 60s, we were really, you know, amplifying traditional music. We were taking some of the very old songs, you know, the ballads that go back to 1600, and to turn them into rock and roll songs, which was exciting.
And haven't you also often looked back to other songs for things that you've done? For example, you did a tour called 1,000 Years of Popular Music, and you were singing Shenandoah, Blackleg Minor, also Cry Me a River.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also sang Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again.
Yeah, it's a very eclectic show. The Thousand Years Show, which we do from time to time, it's a thing that we tour every few years, and it literally starts in 1000 AD, and we work our way through the centuries slowly. And, you know, so we'll do a song written by, you know, Richard I, who was a great songwriter. Richard I, the Lionhearted, was actually pretty nifty songwriter in his day. Songs by Henry VIII, you know, another fine songwriter. We do madrigals, you know.
What kind of lyrics did Henry VIII have? Cut off her head? back to the unfaithful woman theme?
Unfaithful woman theme? No, he's attributed a song called Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair.
Oh, well, that's the song we all know.
He's also you know, slightly more tenuously attributed Greensleeves, which is a very well-known song.
Well, so you also listen to Britney Spears, obviously. How far do you go? Nicki Minaj?
Absolutely, yeah.
Adele?
On the most recent tour, we did a Nelly Furtado song called Maneater, which I think is a great song. So we're trying to keep our ears open for, you know, the new things as well as the old things.
Could you talk about your creative process, where you get the inspiration for lyrics and music?
I've never had anybody do it successfully. I don't know. You know, I just write stories. You know, I sit down to write fiction, and one thing leads to another.
So you start off with the lyric. Because I have spoken to other songwriters who have said, you know, I could just be doodling on the piano or the guitar, and something grabs me, and then the next thing you know, I'm putting some words to it, and and eventually a song comes out of it.
Well, I do it that way as well. I do it both ways if I can. So you know, starting with music, starting with lyrics, whichever way gets you into the process. That's the hard thing, is getting into the process. And once you're in there, then it's fine.
And how much of it is a reflection of the changes in your life? We mentioned your earlier music was very much out of British traditions. And you live in the United States now.
Yeah, but I seem to write from an inner landscape. I'm not very affected by my surroundings. So I still write very much in a kind of a British framework. And I kind of picture things happening in this very, very British place, you know, time and place. So I'd say things haven't changed that much in that sense.
Where did a song like Good Things Happen to Bad People come from?
I wanted to write a jealousy song. There's a lot of great jealousy songs. There's some great old blues songs about jealousy, for instance, and some great folk songs about it as well. And I wanted to write something in that very sort of very direct way.
Do you ever have writer's block? Because you have been very prolific.
Today?
Huh?
Today, yesterday, the day before yesterday. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. What I try to do to overcome it is to have something half finished that I can be working on. So there's always like 30 or 40 songs that are just, you know, one verses. And I can go in and think, well, I'll just touch that up. You know, it's like, you know, if you're an artist, you know, you might have an unfinished canvas or you prime a canvas just to get you in the mood, you know, to get you get your arm working, you know. So I just try and keep ticking over, I think is the phrase.
And artists will also do a lot of sketches, drawings while they're trying to work out a problem.
Well, absolutely, and I think a songwriter is also doing sketches. You might do a one-verse sketch and then abandon that as something that isn't going anywhere, you know. Happens all the time.
My guest is Richard Thompson. His latest CD is called Electric. It's on New West Records. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We're going to go into the break with Streets of Paradise.
Okay. Thank you.
And actually, we're going to be continuing this Scottish and American connection in our next hour, because we're going to be talking with 1960s pop sensation Lulu, who'll drop by. Plus, we'll take a look at the complex relationship between Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon. They were linked by history, politics, and the marriage of David and Julie. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC receives support from Hands on a Hard Body, a new musical, Made in America, book by I Am My Own Wife's Doug Wright, lyrics by Bring It On's Amanda Green, and music by Trey Anastasio of Phish and Amanda Green. Broadway previews begin February 23rd. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. Holy Name Medical Center's Regional Cancer Center in Teaneck, New Jersey, with access to a broad spectrum of services and equipped with advanced technology. 877-HOLY-NAME or holyname.org. Join New York Public Radio's Community Advisory Board for a public meeting about tactics to interface with city planners on post-Sandy efforts. February 11th at 7 at New York Society for Ethical Culture. Details at 646-829-4000 or wnyc.org.
In observation of Listener Appreciation Month, we now present a sustaining member haiku, as read by Jad Abumrad.
Each morning I rise, calmed and informed by the voice of Sirius. Jordan Schaefer, New York, New York.
Become a sustaining member today. Go to WNYC.org and click on support, or call 1-888-376-WNYC.
WNYC is supported by the New York Philharmonic, celebrating the Chinese New Year on Tuesday, February 12th at 7:30 at Avery Fisher Hall. The evening features pianist Herbie Hancock and the Snow Lotus Trio. More information, nyphil.org. WNYC has two pairs of tickets for the concert. We're giving them away now to the third and fourth callers to reach us at 212-433-9692. We're back with Richard Thompson and listening to another track from his latest CD, Electric, this one called Jet Plane in a Rocking Chair. I wonder where that image comes from.
That's actually an old track. If they were supposed to play a new track, they failed.
That's an old track.
That's from the 70s.
But where did that image come from?
Don't know, drugs or something, I don't know. Can I say?
Lucy in the Sky, I guess.
That kind of thing, yeah.
You're considered by many to be one of the greatest living guitarists. You ever feel that tends to obscure your talents as a songwriter?
Maybe. I don't know. There's guitar fans. There's hardcore guitar fans who don't really care about your songs. They just want to hear the guitar playing. And then there's song fans who don't care about the guitar playing. They just want to hear the songs. I like the people who do both, personally. But, if they buy the record, that's just fine with me.
Did you work really hard at developing your chops as a guitarist? Is this something that came pretty easily to you?
Well, as much as anybody else. I wanted to be a little different from other people. I was determined to not be, one of the herd, and that meant not playing the blues or soul music at the time I was coming out of London,
And it has been pointed out that no matter how good some of those players are, it's very difficult to play an original lick when you're playing the blues. People have recorded blues since the 20s.
It's true. It's very hard. And you can have an original tone and an original sound so that people say, oh, that's, Albert Collins, that's Buddy Guy. But it's hard to be a white suburban kid, and have an original style, original stamp on your music.
Can you speak a bit about dadgad tuning and how it influenced your sound over the years?
I'll take it. That's one of the alternative tunings can give you a very characteristic kind of a Celtic sound. So these days, a lot of folk guitarists playing Dagged. But what it means is that you're playing basically a D suspended four chord. So the things hang over, things ring over in a way that leaves some ambiguity as to what key you're playing in, and whether anything is actually finished, which I think is characteristic of traditional music. Sometimes with traditional music, you're really not sure what the key is, because often it's unaccompanied. You have this kind of this sort of hanging, unresolved feeling to it.
It's been pointed out that in most folk musics, singers are trying to sound like instruments, and mm-hmm. instrumentalists are trying to sound like singers.
Absolutely. It's true of folk music. It's certainly true of jazz. I think it's also true of classical music.
Well, jazz goes out of a folk tradition.
Someone like Chopin was concerned about the singing line of a melody. So even if you're playing the piano, you're trying to vocalize the piano.
Well, how does that fit in when you're collaborating with other musicians? I mean, you've worked with a wide range of people, Michael Stipe of REM, John Lydon of the Sex Pistols and mm-hmm. Public Image, more experimental artists like Bill Laswell and Henry Kaiser. I guess you don't want to be pigeonholed, but do you have to adjust your style?
I think sometimes you do, yes. Everyone that you collaborate with brings something different. And if you're going to do those kind of collaborations, you have to be sensitive, and you have to sometimes mold yourself a little more, into the middle of the music, into the center of it, and not be a sort of an abrasive element at the edge.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up mostly in London.
And what kind of music were you listening to when you were a kid?
Everything. The great thing about growing up in a big town is you've got access to so much style, so many different styles of music. So I was listening to Scottish music, because my family was Scottish. Early rock and roll, folk music in the folk clubs. R&B bands like Yardbirds and The Who, which I go and see, live.
Are both bands with prominent guitarists.
Absolutely.
I assume that inspired you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was great. Yeah, my father was sort of a bad amateur guitar player, but he had great records like Django Reinhardt records and Les Paul records, so I grew up listening to those as well, which is a great inspiration.
Can you play like Django these days?
Ooh, no one can play like Django.
Well, there are a lot of Django imitators.
There's a million, there are a million. There's no one who really gets the kind of the energy and the fire of Django, and also the nuance. He also had tremendous nuance.
Well, he was also missing a finger, and maybe that
two fingers.
So that affected the sound.
It was certainly affected the way he thought about playing. There's great players like John Jorgensen, who's a terrific a gypsy jazz player.
How did Fairport Convention come together in 1967?
We were living in the same area, and we were like-minded. We were concerned about lyrics. We wanted to do songs with really great lyrics, and we didn't want to be a particularly loud band, a sort of a beat you over the head band. So we were very folk influenced, and I think we were just, the only five people in North London who felt the same way.
Well, you became an instant success, not only in England, but in this country. Mm. And then you left the band after just a couple of years.
Seemed like a very long couple of years. I was actually there about five, I think, if you really add it all up. And I suppose I just wanted to try some other things. I've been in band since I was 11 years old, and I just wanted to see what it was like to be on my own and develop ideas myself.
And then you recorded with your then wife, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And that allowed you to do different kinds of material?
I think it did, yeah. And it was nice to write for another vocalist, specifically. Just being the two of us, I think we could cover a wider range of material.
And you still perform some of those songs, don't you?
I do. Well, there's some of those songs I'm fond of, and I like to keep them going.
I seem to remember the last time we talked about your leaving the music business for a little while.
Mm.
What led you to do that?
I think I lost my way, really. I couldn't see where the music scene was going. My music scene didn't seem to be very popular at that point, and it was sort of the age of prog rock and glam rock and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to do something else for a while. So you know, I ran an antique shop for a while.
Well, you had survived the punk rock era.
Well, no, actually, it was punk rock that really straightened me out again, because I thought, oh, here's the energy back in music. So this is the direction, you know, this is new hope.
And then didn't you also have a religious conversion?
Yeah, I became a Muslim back in the 70s.
Sufism.
Sufi, yeah.
Which is the more mystical, peace-loving school of Islam.
I hope so. It's supposed to be the inside, the inner core of Islam. Yeah.
So what effect did that have on your songwriting?
I think in the sense that, you know, if you recognize something and say, this is what I am, you haven't necessarily changed. You were that person before it happened. So I don't think it changed at all.
Well, some of the greatest, there are some very great Sufi poets. I don't know whether that influences.
Oh, that's probably true. Yeah, actually, you're right. People like Jalal ad-Din Rumi and Hafiz, you know, there's some of these tremendous poets from the Middle East would be an influence, yes.
You've also performed with your two kids.
I've got two. Well, I've got three kids who are musicians, and I try and play with all of them whenever we can. We just played together on a cruise ship, which was very exciting.
And now you're going to be touring.
I'm touring starting in the UK in a couple of weeks, and then we come back to the US, and I'm on tour with Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell, which would be great fun.
So you'll be at the Beacon Theatre on March 27th.
Yes, indeed.
Do you still enjoy touring?
Well, I love playing live. I love playing to an audience. So if that means going on the road, then I'm very happy to do it.
Richard Thompson's latest CD is called Electric. He will be, as I said, at the Beacon Theatre with Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell on March 27th. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're going to go out with one of the oldies. Actually, this is from the new album, and Richard Thompson will be doing a live webcast. You can go to soundcheck.org to listen in today at 2 p.m. Your answer, the song.